I was called in after the noise had already settled and the water had gone still, after the lawyers began counting what could be protected and what could not, and after a small community realized that the same last name kept appearing wherever the facts became difficult to explain, which is how I found myself reviewing a case that began with a boat moving too fast through dark water and ended years later with a family name stripped of its certainty. The first report spoke of confusion rather than intent, of young people trying to find their way home and a river that offered no forgiveness. Yet as records accumulated and sworn statements were gathered, it became clear that the crash was not an isolated mistake, but the opening event in a sequence that exposed how influence functions when tested by death. I listened to calls, read transcripts, and examined photographs taken long after the immediate emergency had passed. And with each document, the story widened beyond the riverbank, revealing a pattern of delay, denial, and selective accountability that would later frame a homicide investigation few believed possible. By the time the state completed its work, the crash, the lawsuits, and the killings could no longer be separated from one another, because they all involved the same family, beginning with Tom Murdaugh and Mallory Beach. I first approached the boat crash by reconstructing the ordinary context that existed before anything went wrong, because understanding what was normal was the only way to identify where the deviation occurred, and the records were clear that the evening began without the expectation of disaster. Statements placed a group of young adults together after a social gathering, moving between familiar locations along the South Carolina coast, with alcohol present, and no immediate plan beyond returning home, which in that area often meant traveling by water rather than road. The boat itself was a common recreational vessel, operated by someone who had used it before, and while alcohol consumption would later become central to the investigation, the early hours were described by witnesses as routine, social, and unremarkable. When I reviewed the timelines, I noted that multiple stops had been made that evening, including visits to bars and private homes, and that the passengers varied in their recollection of who was piloting the boat at specific moments, a detail that would later complicate both criminal and civil proceedings. The river conditions were dark and cold, with limited visibility, and the route required navigation around fixed structures that were unforgiving if approached at speed. None of the statements suggested that anyone expected trouble, which aligned with the broader pattern I have seen in alcohol-related incidents, where familiarity breeds confidence rather than caution. The crash itself occurred when the boat struck a bridge piling, an impact that threw several passengers into the water and immediately transformed a casual return trip into a rescue emergency. Emergency calls documented panic, disorientation, and uncertainty about who was missing, and responders arriving on scene encountered a chaotic situation complicated by darkness and cold water. Mallory Beach was not accounted for after the impact, and search efforts began almost immediately, extending through the night and into the following days, with family members present and media attention increasing as time passed. In the immediate aftermath, I focused on how the response unfolded, because early decisions often shape later outcomes, and the records showed confusion over jurisdiction, authority, and responsibility. Law enforcement agencies responded, medical personnel treated the injured, and interviews were attempted while emotions were still high, which resulted in inconsistent statements that required later clarification. Alcohol testing became a point of contention, with questions raised about timing, consent, and procedural consistency, all of which would later be examined in court filings. As the investigation progressed, the identity of the operator became central, and evidence pointed toward Paul Murdaugh, whose family name carried significant weight in the local legal system. I reviewed body camera footage and incident reports that documented interactions between responding officers and family members, noting where protocol appeared to bend under pressure, even if no explicit orders were recorded. These early interactions would later be scrutinized for signs of preferential treatment, not because they proved intent, but because they illustrated how influence can alter the tone of an investigation. The search for Mallory Beach concluded days later, when her body was recovered downstream, confirming what had already been feared and converting the incident into a fatality investigation with lasting consequences. Autopsy findings were consistent with blunt force trauma and drowning, aligning with the mechanics of the crash rather than any secondary cause. With that confirmation, civil litigation began to take shape alongside the criminal inquiry, ensuring that the crash would remain active in the courts, even as criminal charges were delayed. In reviewing the civil filings, I noted how responsibility expanded outward from the operator to include establishments that served alcohol and individuals who may have enabled access to the boat, reflecting South Carolina's legal framework for liability in alcohol-related injuries. Depositions revealed a pattern of disputed memories and selective certainty, where witnesses were confident about peripheral details but uncertain about central actions, a common feature in cases involving intoxication. The Murdaugh name appeared repeatedly, not only as a defendant, but as a symbol of institutional familiarity, raising questions that would persist long after the initial case filings. Before anything else changed, the boat crash had already altered the lives of everyone involved, creating legal exposure, public scrutiny, and unresolved grief. Yet at that stage, it remained a singular tragedy, rather than a prelude. I documented the case as one that illustrated the consequences of impaired operation and the challenges of accountability in close-knit communities, unaware that the same family would soon be at the center of a far more direct act of violence. At that point, the focus remained on Mallory Beach, the river, and a legal process moving slowly toward resolution. The case returned to my desk years later, under circumstances no one had predicted, when reports confirmed that Paul Murdaugh and his mother, Maggie Murdaugh, had been found shot and killed on the family's property in June 2021, an event that immediately reframed everything that came before it. I reviewed the homicide scene documentation carefully because the connection between the crash and the killings was not initially evidentiary, but contextual, rooted in timing, pressure, and exposure rather than a single shared act. The property, known as Moselle, was expansive and rural, complicating the scene response and requiring a methodical approach to evidence preservation. Investigators documented two victims, two different firearms, and no immediate suspect outside the family circle, which placed unusual scrutiny on relationships, movements, and digital records. I examined call logs, vehicle data, and location information to establish who had been present and when, relying on verifiable timestamps drawn from phone records and system logs rather than recollection. One piece of evidence emerged as central, a cell phone video recorded shortly before the killings that placed Alex Murdaugh at the scene, despite his initial statements to the contrary. That recording, captured unintentionally, became the anchor point for the prosecution's case, because it contradicted earlier accounts and established presence rather than motive, a distinction that mattered in court. I reviewed the forensic analysis that authenticated the video and aligned it with other digital artifacts, confirming its timing relative to the estimated time of death. The importance of that evidence lay not in what it showed visually, but in what it disproved, removing ambiguity about proximity. As the homicide investigation unfolded, the unresolved boat crash resurfaced in public discourse, not as direct evidence, but as a source of legal and financial pressure bearing down on the family. Civil suits related to Mallory Beach were active, and depositions were approaching that threatened to expose financial irregularities, a fact documented in court schedules and filings. The convergence of these pressures provided context without serving as proof, a distinction investigators were careful to maintain. When Alex Murdaugh was charged and later tried, the proceedings drew national attention, and I monitored the testimony for factual consistency rather than narrative coherence. Witnesses spoke to timelines, forensic findings, and financial records, while the defense challenged interpretations without disputing the existence of key evidence. The jury ultimately returned guilty verdicts for the murders, relying on circumstantial evidence reinforced by digital proof and contradictions in sworn statements. Throughout the trial, references to the boat crash were limited and controlled, introduced primarily to establish motive context, rather than to retry the earlier case. I noted how the court balanced relevance against prejudice, allowing acknowledgement of pending litigation without permitting speculation about intent. This restraint underscored the separation between what could be inferred and what could be proven. The sentencing concluded the criminal proceedings but it did not resolve the broader consequences, because the boat crash litigation continued, now shaped by the outcome of the homicide case. Records showed settlements reached with Mallory Beach's family, reflecting liability considerations rather than criminal findings. The legal dynasty that once dominated the region had been dismantled through documented acts and verified outcomes, rather than rumor. After the verdicts were entered and the appeals process began, I returned to the complete record to assess what the combined cases demonstrated when viewed without speculation or narrative embellishment. The boat crash remained a distinct legal event, defined by alcohol use, negligent operation, and civil liability, while the homicides stood as a separate criminal act proven through forensic and digital evidence. Their connection existed in sequence and consequence rather than causation, a point often misunderstood outside the courtroom. The surviving victims of the crash pursued closure through settlements and public acknowledgement, achieving outcomes documented in court records rather than through symbolic gestures. Mallory Beach's death was formally recognized as a wrongful loss caused by reckless conduct, and the legal process assigned responsibility accordingly. These outcomes did not depend on the later murders, even though public attention often merged the events. For the community, the cases altered perceptions of accountability, demonstrating that influence can delay scrutiny but not prevent it when evidence accumulates. I observed institutional responses evolve over time, with agencies adjusting procedures and oversight in ways that were documented rather than proclaimed. The changes were incremental and procedural, reflecting lessons learned through failure rather than reform driven by admission. From an investigative standpoint, the enduring lesson lay in the value of records, because digital artifacts, financial documents, and preserved communications ultimately carried more weight than reputation or denial. The boat crash generated documentation that later contextualized pressure, while the homicide investigation relied on data that could be verified independent of testimony. In both instances, outcomes were determined by what could be proven, not by what was assumed. What remains is a complete record of events spanning years, each component resolved through its respective legal channel, leaving no unresolved charges or pending factual determinations tied to the central figures. The river, the property, and the courtrooms have returned to routine use, while the files remain closed except for appeals and administrative follow-up. In reviewing the final entries, I found no unanswered questions that could be resolved through investigation alone, only documented conclusions supported by evidence and entered into record, which is where this case now properly ends.